This was the question that we asked last week, but we only looked at negatives. We looked at what we are not and what we are not here to do. So let's back up a few verses, and then we'll continue on into chapter 16 of Mark. We'll be looking to answer those questions with positives, but we're not going to finish this week, so make sure you plan to come back next week. So, at the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land. I think maybe it's a little too loud, Mike. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran and filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. So this was the answer. The centurion's comment was the answer to the more important question that we saw last week. Not who are we, but who was Jesus. But the second question as it relates to Jesus, why was he here, or why was he there at that time, is tied to the same question for us, and that is why are we here? So let's read on. Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. It was preparation day. That's the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. Then, when he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph bought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in the linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He is risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. The reason I underlined "and Peter" is because, as I've said many times, Mark is Peter's account of what happened among his disciples. And so Peter's own place in this is sort of highlighted. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So we looked at the negatives, as I said last week, what we are not here to do. Our purpose for existence is not to bring those who think they are better down to their level. This is what the soldiers who crucified Jesus and the thieves who were crucified with Jesus seemed to think as they mocked Jesus and others who mocked him. Our purpose for being here is not to help God with his plan and make it fit what people want to hear. This is what the Sadducees and their cohorts seemed to think. They didn't like the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. They wanted a different kind of kingdom. They wanted the kind that would put them in power here and now and would relieve their suffering and their humiliation because the Romans were in power over God's own people. But that was not their purpose, and it is not ours, and it's not our purpose to save everyone from government oppression. And this is what they were looking for. Now, I have to believe that each of the gospel writers attempted to cover all of what was essential for us to know about Jesus. And each writer did not assume that we would have access to the other gospels. They weren't all written at the same time. They didn't have printing presses. And so when they wrote, they probably assumed that whoever was reading it, this would be the only gospel that they would have read up to that point. Maybe in some cases, Matthew and Mark, Mark's readers, they might have thought, well, they might have seen Matthew's writings. Mark might have thought that, or Matthew might have thought that, depending on which one was first. But they weren't all there all at the same time, okay? And so we have to believe that what they did write, they believed was what was essential, because they also knew more than what they wrote down. And so they, we should also accept that each of the four gospel writers included some things that were not absolutely essential. Does that make any sense? I have to believe that each of them knew that some of what they wrote was not essential for every person to know. Maybe you've never thought about the first readers of each book in the New Testament. It's highly unlikely that any one person in the first century had all of the other gospels and letters. Highly unlikely. They did not have all of the book of Acts or Revelation. Most people had access to one or two at a time at best. And that was not for, you know, maybe 20 years after Jesus returned to heaven. Many people had to rely on another person telling them what they knew about Jesus and his followers. And then the writers of the Gospels, and of course Paul later wrote to churches, but the writers of the Gospels were writing down the accounts from the apostles and other first-hand witnesses. So Mark, for example, could not assume that any of his readers had access to what Matthew or Luke or John wrote. We've been just looking at what Mark wrote. And Mark almost certainly knew more stories and teachings. John says this, you know, there were many other stories. All of the books wouldn't hold all of what Jesus did. And so Mark, I'm sure, was the same way. There were other stories, there were other teachings that he did not include in his gospel. Not because they weren't important at all, or they just didn't fit into Peter's story as Peter was telling it relating to himself. But Mark believed that if the content of his gospel was the only thing that a person ever read or heard about Jesus, then it would be enough to answer the questions, who am I and why am I here? So the essential things that people needed to know were in Mark's gospel, even though there were some things that he didn't include, and maybe some things that weren't essential for every person to know, because not everything that is in Mark is in Matthew or Luke or John. So these are the essential facts. Who am I and why am I here, that each writer needed to provide? And they provided it in different ways, or the answers to these questions in different ways. So what does that say about the relative importance of the story of Jesus' birth as compared to the importance of Jesus' death and resurrection? The story of Jesus' birth is not insignificant. And it is certainly beautiful. And it is certainly encouraging for our faith. And yet the story of Jesus' birth is not essential to our faith in the sense of our need to know it in order to have what we need, in order to know what we're about. Who am I? Why am I here? We don't have to know the story of Jesus' birth to know the answers to that question. It does have to be true. The story of Jesus' birth has to be true, but it does not have to be known. The story of Jesus' death and resurrection, on the other hand, must not only be true, it must be known. It's not something that could be left out of anyone's account of the good news about Jesus of Nazareth. And so Mark and John and Luke and Matthew all tell us about that. Mark and John did not tell us anything at all about Jesus' birth, but you could take either Mark's gospel or John's gospel to someone who was lost and without hope and never heard anything else, and they could find in either of them everything they needed in order to be rescued from their hopelessness. You cannot provide that same hope without what we find at the end of the four Gospels, okay? So the Gospels are not good news without the bad news. The birth of Jesus is just good news. There's no bad news in that story. Some of the reactions of those at the cross have never been very clear to me. Some of those are left unanswered for me, at least. What about that guy who ran and filled a sponge with wine vinegar and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink? And said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down." He didn't understand the language that Jesus was using when he said, "Eloi, Eloi." Sounded to him like Elijah, Elijah's name in his own language, and the language of a lot of the people there. And so he thought, he's calling Elijah. So, I guess this guy ran to get the sponge and give him something to keep him alive long enough to give Elijah time to get there from wherever he was. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Did he actually think that wherever Elijah was, he was bound by time and space, like we are, and so it was going to take a certain amount of time for him to get there? Jesus needed to stay alive long enough to give Elijah time for the journey? Doesn't make a lot of sense, so I don't have all the answers to these questions. Why did the centurion conclude that Jesus was the Son of God because of the way he died? That's what it says. When the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." I don't think it was that he died more quickly than most, although he did. And I don't think it was merely that he died with a loud cry. There must have been something about the scene that doesn't come through in the words. I guess you had to be there, but I don't mean that in a frivolous way. Maybe there are some answers. I'm going to hint at one possible one, but he may have known about Jesus before, this centurion, as we talked about last week, and he was probably there for the whole trial, but that doesn't explain that one line for me about the way he died having a part in his conclusion that he was the Son of God. Now, I can understand the significance of the mention of the women who were there to a certain extent. It is significant in at least two ways. Some women who were watching from a distance, among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. Now, it's significant that the women who followed him seemed to have a little more courage than the men who followed him. So that's one part of the significance. But it was probably only a little, actually, because for one thing, like Peter, the air conditioning. Okay, it's back. All right. When the air conditioner comes on, sometimes the amplifier goes out. So anyway, it's significant that the women who followed him seemed to have a little more courage than the men who followed him, but probably only a little because, for one thing, like Peter, they were watching from a distance. They weren't right there under the cross like sometimes you see in paintings. For another, they were probably in less danger physically than the men, because they would not have been viewed by the soldiers as much of a threat. You know, they weren't going to take over, you know, the kingdom from the Roman government. So they weren't necessarily fearful in that sense. But the greater significance of their presence near the cross and at his burial is just as witnesses to the facts. And that's why all of these people are named. This is why he names very specific women. Even the names of the women show that Mark was not writing fiction, or he was a very bad writer of fiction, because, you know, you don't have prominent characters with the same first name. And especially if it was the same first name as Jesus' own mother and father, have all these Marys. These are clearly real people who can be identified by many of his first readers. And some of them are still alive to verify what he says that they saw. And they would also have living children and grandchildren. And then think about this other Joseph. Joseph of Arimathea, not his father Joseph, but Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Isn't it interesting that the only person on that day who is given credit for being bold is this Joseph of Arimathea? He was a member of the council. That's another name for the Sanhedrin. This is the court that had called for Jesus' death. He was in that room, on that court, with all of those people. And he wasn't just a member, but a prominent member. So I believe that what Mark means when he says he was himself waiting for the kingdom of God is that he believed in Jesus before the trial and crucifixion. And it took courage to go to the Roman government who had sentenced Jesus to death, but it took more courage to do this because of his fellow council members who were hysterical in their opposition to Jesus. Now, Jesus suffered pain and agony throughout the ordeal, but the greatest agony of all is expressed in the words that he addresses to God. Why have you forsaken me? You really can't make the case that Jesus' physical suffering was any greater than thousands upon thousands of people who were crucified by the Romans. For that matter, there may have been other ways to die that are even more painful. I mean, they used crucifixion because they wanted to torture people. So it was a very painful death. But there are certainly a lot of people who have been, you know, tortured for years before dying. Jesus apparently died more quickly than most of those who died on crosses. And the physical part of the ordeal all took place within one day. Now, I'm in no way minimizing the physical pain and suffering, but there is only so much that a human body can suffer. And the agony of the beating, the crown of thorns, the spikes through his hands and feet, and the suffocation that resulted from hanging with the weight of his body, making it nearly impossible to breathe, all of that pales in comparison to the agony of being separated from God. When Jesus cried out, "Why have you forsaken me?" it was not hyperbole. Hyperbole is a figure of speech. There's nothing wrong with figures of speech, including hyperbole. Hyperbole is an exaggeration, like saying, "That's the worst. I can't stand it when someone does that." Well, unless you literally fall to the ground, you can't stand, you could say that that's a lie. You can stand it. But since we know what someone means by this, it's not a lie. It's, you know, the truth. It is hyperbole, though. Well, Jesus did sometimes use hyperbole in order to communicate, but this is not one of those times. This is not hyperbole. He was not suffering such intense physical pain that it felt as if God had forsaken him. He was actually suffering the far more intense spiritual pain of actually being without his Father. And maybe those are the words that explain why the centurion said, because of the way he died. I don't know. Because he heard that. But we saw him in the garden praying that he might somehow be spared from what he knew was coming. He knew that it would be far worse than anything he had ever experienced, but it was beyond comprehension, even for him. He didn't know everything. He was in the body. He had let go of equality with God. He had come as a man subject to death. So we've talked about Jesus' humanity and how he was not omniscient while he was a man. His insights came from his spiritual connection with God, from inspiration, from the Holy Spirit. But he was still subject to the need for faith, just like we are. Now, in order for Jesus to suffer what we deserve to suffer, his spiritual insight had to be taken from him. So he had to be stripped of all consciousness of hope. How does a person endure years of torture and solitary confinement? As you know, we talked about James Stockdale last week and many others, that are put into situations of torture. How do they survive that if they have the means to put an end to the suffering? Why do so many cling to life? Why do not all of them commit suicide who have the ability to do that? It's because of hope. That's it. As long as we have a sense of hope, we can endure incredible suffering. We're driven to the conclusion that Jesus felt what it was to be without hope. He was so completely separated from God that he did not know at that moment that there would be an end to it. Now, while he was in that state of being, he could not know that there would be an end to it. The lack of hope was the essence of that state of being. The lack of hope is what hell is. That's it. Separation from God. No hope. Now, as he was preparing for this, Jesus did believe that it would end. We know that. I mean, he plainly had told his followers, in Mark, three times he told them that after 3 days he would rise. So he didn't leave them without the hope of being reunited with him. But what I am saying is that once God left him while he was on the cross, he had no capacity for hope or any other spiritual insight that would provide any comfort. This was what was necessary. This was what my sins and yours made necessary. He was never in danger of being abandoned for eternity. But he could not know that. It was necessary for him to suffer the hopelessness that we all deserve when we rebel against God. There's one other fact that Mark sees fit to include, although it seems unrelated to anything else in the account. The only reason it would be included in a paragraph with anything else is the idea that it's bad style to have a one-sentence paragraph. It just seems to come out of nowhere. I'm talking about the statement, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Because the curtain was torn from top to bottom, it was an act of God, not man. You know, it was a very, very heavy curtain by the historical accounts that we have. So it would have been hard for any men to tear it apart, but there could have been a way, you know, to tear it from bottom to top, but not from top to bottom. Because the curtain was torn from top to bottom, it was an act of God, not man. But what did it mean? Why did God do it? The curtain of the temple was the only thing that kept everyone who was in the court, the temple court, from seeing into the Holy of Holies. The front of the temple was open, and that was the holy place. And then there was the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place, that was behind that. And only the high priest, one time a year, went into the Holy of Holies to take the blood from the lamb that was sacrificed for the sins of the community in there to put it on the Ark of the Covenant. Well, this is, you know, where the Ark of the Covenant was supposed to have been. The wings of the cherubim on it were spread downward, and that was called the seat of God. And if there was an ark in the Holy of Holies at this time, it was certainly not the original ark. See, that ark represented God's presence in the temple and in the Jewish religion, in the Jewish community. Well, there's no evidence that even a replica of the ark was there. And I believe that the curtain was torn to reveal an empty room. I don't think anything was in the room. But only the high priests, you know, knew that personally because they went in there one time a year. Now, even if the original ark had been there, the removal of the curtain would have done away once and for all with the idea that was a big problem for the Jews, and that was the idea that God was only the God of the Jews. And this was the center of their community, and this proved it. Well, the sacrifice was made that allowed God to open the door. Jesus was the sacrifice. The sacrifice was made that allowed God to open the door to all people with full justification. No longer would the one high priest bring blood from the sacrificial lamb on the Day of Atonement to sprinkle on the seat of God and roll the sins forward for just 1 year. That's what had been happening all of these years. The true lamb has now been sacrificed, and the huge cumulative blood of sin that has been growing larger and larger each year, like a snowball rolling down a mountain, is now gone forever. So this was God's answer to the question, why have you forsaken me? Why? Why did God have to forsake his son and leave him alone without feeling any hope? Well, the blood of an involuntary lamb that doesn't volunteer to be there, doesn't want to be there, doesn't know what's going on, but still doesn't want to be there, does not justify forgiveness for my sin. You know, didn't justify it for the Israelites, doesn't justify it for me or you. But the blood of a completely innocent and willing volunteer allows that volunteer to name the price for the unjust suffering, the injustice that he endured while God's back was turned. I'll let you read through that a couple of times. Okay, so it's now justified. The story of the manger is beautiful, but without the story of the cross, it's just a cute story. And many people who don't really have faith in the story of the cross still love the story of the birth, right? But it's the story of the cross that is essential for us all. So let's stand together and let's sing with this video.